Hi, I'm Steve Coburn, proud owner of Country Air Pet Resort here in Reading. I invite you to come and take a tour of my revitalized pet resort. Our goal here at Country Air is to make sure your pet can relax and have a healthy, happy time away from home. With friendly, caring people, lots of fresh air and exercise, good healthy food, and plenty of pampering. There are no small cages here. What we offer are large temperature-controlled runs and spacious exercise yards that are great for fun and socialization. We even offer daycare. Cats are treated to a two-room apartment plus playtime in our playroom. So stop by and take a tour of the best. You and your pet will want to come back to Country Air Pet Resort, where our motto is, we treat your pets as if they were our own. Country Air Pet Resort, 549-3335.
From the historic campus of Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, where the good, the true, and the beautiful are taught, nurtured, and honored, this is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, bringing the activity and education of the college to listeners across the country.
They wanted to make money, and telling black potential customers that you'll be treated differently and worse is not a good way to make money. So, in free market capitalism, the most important color is green. And that is why you see a divergence between what can go on in the government in terms of discrimination, where there is no cost, and what goes on in the private sector.
This is your host, Scott Bertram. Welcome to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, part of the Hillsdale College Podcast Network. That was Jason L. Riley, author of the new book, The Affirmative Action Myth: Why Blacks Don't Need Racial Preferences to Succeed. We'll talk in depth with Jason about that book later on in today's program. First, we're joined by Dr. Brad Berzer. He is Professor of History and Russell Amos Kirk Chair in American Studies here at Hillsdale College. Dr. Berzer, thanks for joining us.
Hey, Scott. Always great talking to you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. We're going to spend some time today talking a bit about Ray Bradbury and more so on his continued relevance today.
Sure.
You're a Bradbury fan. Where did you begin reading Bradbury, and why did you find his work so worthy of your continued attention?
Yeah, I've never stopped liking him. I first encountered him. I grew up in a household where reading was always encouraged, and all kinds of things. And in fact, I look back now and I'm kind of shocked at some of the things my mom handed me to read at the time. But in grade school, I don't remember if it was in fourth or fifth grade, we started reading a Ray Bradbury story about a girl on Venus and the story is that Venus is always cloudy, but there's this one moment where the sun comes out every 7 years or so and it stops raining. And this girl has seen this because she's from Earth, but she tells her classmates about this. They don't believe her. And so when the moment comes and the sun actually comes out on Venus, the kids cruelly lock this girl in a closet. And so she's not able to enjoy the sun, this thing she's just been dreaming about forever. It just grabbed me as a kid. And from there, I read Martian Chronicles. I read The Illustrated Man. I read The October Country. Yeah, so probably late grade school for me. Mm-hmm. And then when I got into junior high, I read Fahrenheit 451. And I was going through a very strong at the time, partly because of my mom as well, but going through a really strong libertarian streak, even as eighth and ninth grader. I was really getting into politics at that time. And Fahrenheit 451 it changed my mind, changed my life. It shook me down to the core in the way that really only Brave New World or 1984 could do. I saw it, and I still do. I saw it as kind of an equal to one of those books, mm-hmm. One of the great dystopian novels of the 20th century, and That Hideous Strength by C.S. Lewis, too. Those are really the four greats, I think.
You've written often on Bradbury over at the Imaginative Conservative. There is a three-part biography series. You wrote reviews of each of those parts. There's a story you wrote, essay at the American Conservative, headlined, Ray Bradbury,
was the coolest nonconformist on the planet. Why do you say that?
Oh, he was always his own man. Always in everything that he did. He didn't write for the market. He wrote for himself. And it worked beautifully. He never conformed to what was going on in Hollywood, what was going on in Los Angeles. He always did his own thing. In the long run, it worked. And not that he didn't have a lot of setbacks in his life, but he just was always his own man. And I don't even agree with all of his political views by any means, but I admire him for them. So in 1952, when the Republicans won the White House, Ray Bradbury took a full page out in Variety, basically reminding them of what their campaign promises had been and what they had to do and to live up to that. And that, you know, the FBI started a file on him. He was not pro-communist at all. In fact, he was extremely anti-communist, but he was also very pro Bill of Rights. Mm-hmm. And in the 1950s, that was a dangerous position to take because of McCarthyism. So that's part. I mean, there's just a lot of things, Scott, to try and answer that. But I just have always admired Bradbury. And again, from when I was a kid all the way up to my adult life. And you know, I was reviewing for the Imaginative Conservative. I was reviewing Jonathan Eller's yes. three-part work. And I know you've had Jonathan on before. And what a great guy. Another person I would highly recommend is Sam Weller, who wrote a one-volume biography of Bradbury as well. And so there's really no need right now for a good Bradbury biography. There are two out there. But yeah, I just kind of devoured those as well. So partly because I find the man endlessly fascinating.
Talking with Brad Berzer here about Ray Bradbury, and want to look at some of his works and themes and sort of pull them through to what we can learn and what we can perhaps think about today. You mentioned Fahrenheit 451 being such an important work in your life. So let's start there.
Yeah.
Some of the themes of censorship, the themes of freedom of thought in Fahrenheit 451, how do you think that they might help us consider today's themes and questions about free speech and information control of the way that we receive information?
Right. The story is a beautiful story. It's crazy story at times too, but it's a beautiful story. It's about this fireman, and in the future, the firemen burn books rather than save houses because all the houses have been basically, I forget how Bradbury, it doesn't make a lot of sense, but they've been given some kind of plastic coating so nothing burns anymore. So they take these kerosene tanks around and they burn books. And the reason that they burn books is because books give opinions, and they're trying to find a kind of tapioca, vanilla way of thinking about life in which there are no minorities, but everybody's a part of the majority. And, you know, again, for 1953, that's a pretty stunning kind of look, because when we look at something like Brave New World, it's all about chemicals and what we do to ourselves in terms of taking chemicals. And then you look at 1984, and it's very fascistic. Even though it's communism, it's the boot that's coming down on the face. And what I think is great about Bradbury's Fahrenheit 451 is it looks at what de Tocqueville would have called soft despotism or democratic despotism. And so these people are still free. They are very free to do what they want. But what they want to do is just simply watch TV all day long. They don't want to be bothered with ideas. And so it's not very clear in the book, was this a cultural moment and movement to burn books, or was it a government movement? But I think those themes are fascinating. You know, how often do we take for granted our freedom? How often do we take for granted our liberty? And I think we do a lot. And that's what Bradbury's really reminding us of and saying, you know, you've got to embrace these things. And you know, for him, it's books that we really have to cherish. So, you know, famously later on, Bradbury, of course, was always interviewed about Fahrenheit 451 because it became a classic. But he often said that as he was thinking about books themselves, he recognized that all we had to do to censor ourselves was simply to stop reading. And that's what I think he's really worried about in this.
Also in Fahrenheit 451 are, as you allude to, critiques of mass culture, superficial entertainment. How do you think that might compare to today's media landscape, in which it's interesting that we have more choices right?
Right.
With which to find news and information. But occasionally that means we're not seeing the same things across society.
Yeah, I'm not sure how to answer that, Scott. It's a great question. And I think that it's so complicated right now. You know, just look at our Twitter feed and what's going on Twitter, or look at social media in general. There's so many sources of things. You know, and I look at the New York Times every morning, and I'm always surprised at just how biased the headlines are, what's going on with that. And National Review is biased too, but they wear their bias. They're not trying to hide it at all. So I think that we're in a strange spot, one that I'm no expert on, Scott, at all. But I think we're in a strange spot right now, a little bit different than what Bradbury predicted, because he really predicted a kind of monoculture. Mm-hmm. And I don't think we have that. We've got serious diversity, but within that diversity, we have a lot of conformity as well.
We'll continue in a moment with Dr. Brad Berzer from Hillsdale College on the enduring legacy of Ray Bradbury. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Reading, say big on Black Bear Diner's new basket bundles. Get your paws on a choice of sandwich, side, and drink for only $11. Basket bundles, now available at Black Bear Diner. Join us Father's Day weekend, June 14th and 15th. It's the perfect place to celebrate and treat Dad to fun, food, and family. Black Bear Diner also added four brand new and returning classics to the menu at 2205 Hilltop Drive. Get big value and so many choices at Black Bear Diner.
Black Bear Diner.
Sinorama presents Brews by the Bridge at Turtle Bay in Redding on Saturday, June 21st, 5 p.m. to 9 p.m.
Join us for this unforgettable 21-plus event featuring over 20 craft breweries, live music, games, delicious food, and more.
Next to the Sundial Bridge along the Sacramento River.
With cold beer, great company, and outdoor fun.
All proceeds support Turtle Bay's educational programs and exhibitions.
Don't miss Brews by the Bridge at Turtle Bay, Saturday, June 21st. Get your tickets now at turtlebay.org.
Need help with your health insurance? We've got you covered. At Shasta Community Health Center, we offer this free service to our community. Our enrollment counselors can assist you with new applications, renewals, troubleshooting, and answering your questions about covered California plans or Medi-Cal, also known as Medicaid or Partnership Health Plan. We're here to help you make the best choice for you and your family. Call our outreach and enrollment team at 530-229-5117 to get help today. Shasta Community Health Center, because SCHC cares.
Hi, this is Judy Maxwell. Life can happen in an instant. Sometimes you plan for it, like retirement or taking care of your family. Sometimes it's a surprise, like a winter storm with home or property damage. Sometimes it may be an unexpected accident or illness or even a premature death. Whatever life throws at you, you'll wish you had gotten the right insurance when you had the chance. That's where Maxwell Insurance can help. For more than a quarter century, we've been serving the North State because it's our home, too. Give us a call at 221-0441 to let us help you review your policies and prepare you for whatever your future holds. Maxwell Insurance, 1378 Hilltop Drive, 221-0441.
Alan Gordon, Coachmaster Collision. Although Coachmaster is recognized as the authority and specialist in frame and suspension, we are primarily your auto body and truck collision repair center. This includes all vehicles, Lexus, Honda, or pickup trucks. Our technicians are highly trained and have the most advanced equipment to ensure a complete and quality repair. With our knowledge and the insurance claim process, all we need is your claim number to handle your claim. Coachmaster has a great working relationship with all insurance companies. This ensures a complete repair with quality parts and a delay-free process. At Coachmaster, in our 50 years in business, we've experienced almost every situation imaginable in a claim. This experience and personal dedication to the repair of your vehicle sets Coachmaster apart from all other choices. And yes, if we can't fix it, no one can.
Learn more online at CoachmasterAutobody.com. Hi, it's Mark from Haven Humane Society. Are you looking to add to your family? We have puppies, kittens, small critters, and farm animals. Each year, we have thousands of amazing animals looking for homes come into our lives, and we hope to have them join yours. Follow us on social media and find our links on our website at havenhumane.org. Watch our weekly content on YouTube, like our Mark's Monday mashup, when we talk about what's going on and introduce you to our team and adoptable animals. Get involved. Volunteer. Thank you for all your continued support. Together, we are moving closer to our ultimate goal of a North State with no more homeless pets.
We're back on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram, talking with Dr. Brad Berzer, professor of history here at Hillsdale College, and Russell Amos Kirk Chair in American Studies, about the enduring legacy of Ray Bradbury, who died 13 years ago this weekend. Dr. Berzer.
Before we move on from Fahrenheit 451, what leaped out at you? What leapt out at you as you read the first time, and perhaps still speaks to you today about Fahrenheit 451?
Yeah, one of the things now when I reread it, I love the story of Clarice, who's the young girl who gets Montag, the main character, gets him to think about his life. And, if you don't mind, Scott, I wanted to read this passage. To me, this is just Bradbury at his best, and it's very romantic. He turned the corner. The autumn leaves blew over the moonlit pavement in such a way as to make the girl who was moving there seem fixed to a sliding walk, letting the motion of the wind and the leaves carry her forward. Her head was half bent to watch her shoes stir the circling leaves. Her face was slender and milk white, and it was a kind of gentle hunger that touched over everything with tireless curiosity. It was a look almost of pale surprise. The dark eyes were so fixed to the world that no move escaped them. Her dress was white and it whispered. He almost thought he heard the motion of her hands as she walked, and the infinitely small sound now, the white stir of her face, turning when she discovered she was a moment away from a man who stood in the middle of the pavement waiting. I love that romantic description. She's very much a part of nature, and she's reminding him, and she will remind him of really what is good and true and beautiful. And he's moved by this young girl and her ability to kind of understand the world. And he asks her, why aren't you watching TV? Well, it's kind of boring. So what are you doing? I'm going for a walk. Well, it's late at night. Why are you going for a walk? Just to see things, And it's a normal moment and yet a beautiful moment. But I think, and that's not the main theme of Fahrenheit 451, but that romanticism and Bradbury's ability to write so well.
Brad Berzer with us as we talk about Ray Bradbury and some of his relevance, continued relevance today. A story from Bradbury at the Veldt involving advanced technology and its consequences. What do you think his portrayal in that story says about perhaps or helps us understand about our current reliance on digital devices?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. What a cautionary tale. What a beautiful tale that Bradbury wrote. And the parents do not come off well in that story at all. They don't come off well in terms of the way they present themselves. And of course, their ending is rather dire as well. So the story of the Veldt is the story of having a kind of playroom in which there are these active screens going on, these TVs that are, and you can interact with them. And the parents use it as a babysitter. And the children don't like this. They like the TV. They don't like the parents, and they know that they're being kind of used. And so they set up this revenge in which the parents will actually be taken out by what's going on in the TV. So totally fantastic, of course. It is a fantasy. But what an amazing commentary on how do we raise our kids, and are they all tied to screens, and are we allowing social media to become their babysitter? Yeah, those are very relevant questions, even though that story dates back to the early 1950s.
Yes.
Again, and there's, Bradbury, he's known for his science fiction, but he's not known for his science, right? And yet he predicted AirPods, and he predicted Walkman, and he predicted TVs in the way that they kind of developed. It's amazing to think about all the stuff that I think he envisioned without being a scientific guy at all.
Let's take a look at The Silent Towns, another Bradbury piece that explores human connection, loneliness, certainly, man, we have so many stories today, especially among our young adults, about social loneliness and mental health issues, the effects of isolation. Again, even though we are very connected, the effects of sort of personal isolation. What about the silent towns?
Oh, well, that of course is in the Martian Chronicles, and one of the great chronicles. And what we have in that story is a man who has been out mining in the mountains of Mars, and he comes back and the planet's been deserted. It's been evacuated. Everybody's gone back to Earth. Not quite everybody, but almost everybody. And at first he loves this. He's a loner, and so he just takes advantage of the town. He makes himself ice cream sundaes, and he walks around town, and he enjoys himself. And then he realizes he's lonely, and he hears a phone ring, and he runs into the house to get the phone. He misses it. The phone then rings in the next house, and he keeps chasing it. And he finally gets on the phone, and it's a woman. And she has a nice voice, and she's polite. And he thinks, oh, this is going to be great. We need to meet. It's just going to be the two of us. It's like, just the two of us on Mars. And then they meet, and he doesn't like her at all. He doesn't like the way she looks. He doesn't like the way she acts. And so then the rest of the story is him getting away from all of this and going back to his lonely life. And we do encounter him one more time in the Martian Chronicles, when the spaceship has come back, and it's a long story, but a spaceship has returned, and they're looking for the population. And they said they found this old kind of crazy miner out in the mountains, but he was happy. Yeah. So anyway, we don't know what happened to the woman, but we know what happened to the man.
She's still dialing numbers, perhaps.
Maybe.
Talking with Brad Berzer here about Ray Bradbury. In what ways do you think that Bradbury has influenced more modern science fiction? What did he bring to the genre that perhaps still lives on today?
Yeah, I think he did a number of things in terms of influencing later thinkers and later writers. So his golden era is really from about 1943 until about 1962, when he publishes Something Wicked This Way Comes. And it's not that he stops publishing. In fact, he wrote a whole series of mystery novels towards the end of his life. He never stopped writing short stories. He was writing all the time. But really, that golden era was that kind of a 20-year period, early 40s to early 1960s. And he had a huge influence on other writers like Russell Kirk, very taken. In fact, they were good friends, used to go vacation together, and really enjoyed each other's company. And of course, Kirk wrote short stories. He's best known for being the founder of modern conservatism, mm-hmm. but he was also a ghost story writer, wrote three novels. Mm-hmm. Stephen King, I think, is probably the person who's been most influenced by Bradbury. And in 1983, Stephen King published, I'm not quite sure how to pronounce it, but he published a book called Dance Macabre. And it's a history of horror and science fiction. And he gives a chapter to Bradbury, and especially Something Wicked This Way Comes, as basically laying the foundation of all modern horror mm-hmm. into the 70s and 80s. And I'm not an expert on that genre. I've read a lot of Stephen King, but I'm not, and I've read a lot of Dean Koontz. And it seems clear to me that they were both very influenced by Bradbury, by his themes, not necessarily his writing style. Stephen King, right? You can't go a page without the F word. And you can't even imagine Bradbury saying something like that, let alone writing it. So I don't mean to suggest that there's a perfect synchronicity between the two, but I think that definitely he had an influence.
Dr. Brad Berzer, professor of history, Russell Amos Kirk Chair in American Studies here at Hillsdale College, and also Ray Bradbury fan. You can find his writing at The Imaginative Conservative and the piece mentioned over at The American Conservative elsewhere as well. Dr. Berzer, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
It was excellent, Scott. Thank you.
Up next, Jason L. Riley, fellow at the Manhattan Institute and columnist at the Wall Street Journal, talks about his new book, The Affirmative Action Myth. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
When people ask me for a recommendation for a heating or air conditioning company, I always say Alliance Heating and Air. Why? Well, they've been taking care of our HVAC system for 14 years. Professional, friendly, and willing to go to the extra step for their customers. I have found no problem too difficult or too minor for them to repair. I recommend Alliance Heating and Air with no reservations. You can reach them at 530-221-2642 or online at homecomfort.org. and they have 24/7 emergency assistance. Alliance Heating and Air.
For over 50 years, House of Realty has provided experienced and effective advice to its real estate clients. Experts in residential, commercial, and investment property, we have the knowledge and tools to assist you with all of your real estate needs. Family owned and operated since 1965, we have been an active part of the Shasta County community for generations. Please call House of Realty today at 241-8300. A reputation for excellence since 1965.
At the Community Foundation of the North State, we believe strong communities start with generosity and connection. As a grant-making public charity for over 25 years, we link people who care with causes that matter, supporting education, the arts, health, and more across the North State. Together, we're creating a lasting impact right here at home. The Community Foundation of the North State. Local giving, powerful results. Visit cfnorthstate.org to learn more. A proud sponsor of the Reading Colt 45s.
This is Ted Leidy with Northern Firearms Instruction. Obtaining a California concealed weapons license will allow the licensed individual to transport a listed handgun in their vehicle or on their person in public. For application instructions, training, and other information, contact NFI at 530-999-1822 or visit us online at usgunpro.com. This is Ted Leidy, and remember, it's our right and our responsibility.
This Hawaiian mini vacation is brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning. So what does professional office cleaning have to do with relaxing in a tropical paradise? Frankly, nothing. But Maui Bob and the crew want to remind you to be sure to take the time for what's important in this workaday world. Family, friends, and yes, even yourself. And if their professional office cleaning services can help you make that time, give them a call at 221-5868. This Hawaiian mini vacation was brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning, 221-5868.
Attention veterans, did you know that Shasta College and Simpson University have veterans resource centers to assist you in your educational pursuits? These centers offer a wide range of support services, including financial aid, tutoring, IT support, and more. We understand the unique challenges that veterans face and are committed to helping you succeed. Our experienced staff is here to help you navigate the college experience and achieve your academic and career goals. Don't let anything stand in your way. This message is brought to you by Senator Maurice Johannesson, former Secretary of California Veterans Affairs.
Owners, landlords, and tenants trust Authority Property Management at 2663 Victor Avenue. They manage a variety of properties, including single-family homes, apartments, condos, townhouses, multifamily properties, and commercial properties. Authority Property Management offers full-time management, including finding and screening tenants, rent collection, financial reporting, and final walkthrough home inspections when they move out. Contact Authority Property Management today at 530-410-6085 and check out their website at authoritypm.com.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. Be sure to check out the Hillsdale College Podcast Network at podcast.hillsdale.edu. You'll find older episodes of this program, plus many other Hillsdale College podcasts at podcast.hillsdale.edu. We're joined by Jason L. Riley, Senior Fellow at the Manhattan Institute and a columnist for the Wall Street Journal, also author of the new book, The Affirmative Action Myth: Why Blacks Don't Need Racial Preferences to Succeed. Jason, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
So the affirmative action myth looks at trends, both before and after affirmative action takes effect. Where's that dividing line? Where do you try to break that data?
Well, right around 1970 is when the federal government started putting in place goals and timetables. So I really date the modern affirmative action era to around 1970. In the late 1960s, you had schools, universities start to lower standards to admit more black students. So in academia, you could say it started a little earlier, but officially, based on the federal government, quotas and timetables and set asides date to 1970 or so. So that's generally what I'm talking about. It's also worth explaining the original meaning of affirmative action and what it became later. Mm-hmm. So in the late 60s, it starts as an effort to reach out to groups that traditionally had been overlooked, namely blacks, and help those groups rise to existing standards. What it later became was all about lowering standards to reach racial balance. And that is what it means today. And that is essentially how I use the term throughout the book.
Jason L. Riley, the book, The Affirmative Action Myth. One of the key points you make, black people essentially lifted themselves out of poverty in the first two thirds of the 20th century. So as you compare data from pre-affirmative action, post-affirmative action, what kind of progress was being made in the pre-Civil Rights era, pre-Civil Rights Act era, the pre-Voting Rights Act era?
Well, some of the most striking data is in poverty reduction. So between 1940 and 1960, the black poverty rate fell from 87% to 47%. So a 40-point percentage drop. And 1960 is not only before affirmative action and DEI, it's before the Civil Rights Act of 1964. It's before the Voting Rights Act of 1965. It's before blacks had any real political power in this country in terms of mayors of large cities with large black populations, which you wouldn't really see until the 70s and 80s. So tremendous amounts of progress were simply being made in terms of blacks lifting themselves out of poverty, and yet the narrative out there, particularly on the left, is that affirmative action lifted blacks out of poverty. And I say that's not what the historical record shows. Other data that can be referenced has to do with educational attainment, mm-hmm. the rate at which blacks are increasing their years of schooling, not only in absolute terms, but relative to whites. That gap was closing. Black incomes were rising as well because in this country, of course, the more educated you are, the more prospects you have in the job market, in the labor market. So high school graduation, college completion rates were rising. And all of the home ownership rates are another thing you can point to. And all of these trends start to slow or stall or even reverse course beginning in the 1970s, beginning in the era of affirmative action. So, for example, college completion rates, the gap between whites and blacks was closing through the 50s, and you get to 1970, and suddenly this progress stops for blacks. College completion today is right around where it was in 1970, after 50 years of affirmative action.
You find that much of the black progress occurred in the pre-affirmative action era in the private sector, even though discrimination was legal. How was that? How do we explain that?
Well, what a free market system does is put a price on discrimination. You know, capitalism doesn't mean that there'll be no more racism, there'll be no more discrimination, but it does put a price on it. So if you are, an employer and you refuse to hire blacks, that might require you to hire whites at higher rates, to hire less effective people to get the job done. That could put you at a competitive disadvantage with other employers who hire regardless of race. So you'll have to pay a price for that. You'll take a risk. If you're a landlord who owns rental units and you refuse to rent to Hispanics, that means you could have units that remain vacant for long periods of time. Again, it may cost you. And so that is what is going on in the private sector. It's interesting. If you go back and look at one of the definitive moments in civil rights history in this country was the Montgomery bus boycott, mm-hmm. Led by Martin Luther King back in the 1950s. And back in that time, the buses in the city were run by private companies. The companies did not want segregated riders. They didn't want blacks to have to sit in the back of the bus.
That was something that the government imposed on them, and they fought it. They did not want those laws in place. Again, they wanted to make money, and telling black potential customers that you'll be treated differently and worse is not a good way to make money. So in free market capitalism, the most important color is green, and that is why you see a divergence between what can go on in the government in terms of discrimination, where there is no cost, and what goes on in the private sector.
Jason L. Riley with us. His new book, The Affirmative Action Myth, Why Blacks Don't Need Racial Preferences to Succeed. If this progress was being made in the pre-affirmative action era, and theoretically those changes would help, right? That's the intent behind them. What was happening to prevent that from happening? Why did affirmative action prevent further progress?
Well, partly it has to do with the incentives that were put in place in terms of economic progress. Well-intentioned policies that put in place adverse incentives. So if you're going to expand the welfare state and pay people not to work, you're going to get more people who aren't working. And if you're going to pay people more money than they can earn by taking a job, they're making a economically rational choice not to join the labor market and cut the amount of money they have coming in. We saw some of this during COVID when the government was issuing checks to people and the private sector could not compete with the income, the added income that people were receiving because of those government checks. So people stayed home from work. It's a perfectly rational thing to do. Mm-hmm. But that's what you saw with the rise of the Great Society and the welfare state. The other problem that blacks faced beginning in the late 1960s was the rise of single-parent homes. And so what you had seen throughout the 40s and the 50s was this convergence in incomes between blacks and whites. Whites were ahead, and both groups were gaining, but blacks were gaining on whites. They were catching up. You were seeing a reduction in income inequality. That starts to slow in the late 1960s. And it slows because that's when you start to see this proliferation of single-parent homes. Mm-hmm. And, of course, a single-parent home is probably bringing in less money than a dual-parent home. And so the breakdown of the black family helped to contribute to the slowing trends that we saw in the 50s and 60s. And that's an important point to make here. Because in addition to all the other negative outcomes we associate with single parent families, single parent homes are just bringing in less money. Mm-hmm. And that is going to hurt the economic progress of a group. And that's what we started to see in the late 60s and continued to see. So as recently as the early 60s, 2 out of 3 black children were raised in a home with a mother and a father. 30 years later, 3 and 4 would not be. And that had a huge impact on those pre-existing positive trends that we saw going on in black America.
More in a moment. Jason Riley with us, his book, The Affirmative Action Myth. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Every day, your life is filled with choices. And when a health crisis happens, you need to be prepared to choose the best healthcare partner. That's when Shasta Regional Medical Center is there to answer the call above the rest. Ranked best in Reading and in the nation for patient safety and clinical excellence, you can be confident that when you choose Shasta, you are choosing superior care, safety, and excellence for you and your family. Choose Shasta at ShastaRegional.com.
North Valley Distributing at 3081 Crossroads Drive is a major supplier of electrical and electronic products for the industrial and construction markets. North Valley Distributing focuses on quality and reliability. Their products include fuses, batteries, wiring devices, connectors, lighting solutions, circuit protection components, and electrical tools and more. North Valley Distributing at 3081 Crossroads Drive. A proud sponsor of the Reading Colt 45.
What is happening in the state of Jefferson? To find out, listen to the Jefferson State of Mind program Sunday mornings at 9 a.m. on KCNR with your hosts Wynn Carpenter and Terry Raposa and Janet Chandler. To catch up on past broadcasts or to listen anytime, go to KCNR1460.com and click on the archive link.
Come out and play. Have you seen the building? We
all have to pay. The time has come for 51 in a Jefferson state of mind.
Hi, this is Chuck Kinney, owner of Shasta Gas Propane. Have you been affected by some of the recent changes in business ownership here in Shasta and Tehama counties? These changes follow a national trend where national companies buy up locally owned small family companies and change the culture and staff and pricing of their product. That has occurred here in the North State also. Three locally owned propane companies have been purchased by large national companies. If you're like me and you prefer to deal with locally owned companies, you may be interested to know Shasta Gas Propane, which has been around for 28 years, now has the third generation working in the company. For locally owned, family operated service and care, give us a call at 530-365-3793. Thank you.
Good morning, Reading. This is Rick Hughes, host of The Flatline. Heard every Sunday morning on KCNR 96.5 FM at 7 a.m. in the morning. Just want you to know that God has given us two ends, one to think with and one to sit on. And success in life depends on which one you use. It's heads you win and tails you lose. Come join me on The Flatline and learn about God's tremendous problem-solving device. 7 a.m. every Sunday morning, 96.5 FM, KCNR.
We're back on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. Joined by Jason Riley, we continue talking about his new book, The Affirmative Action Myth, Why Blacks Don't Need Racial Preferences to Succeed. Jason Riley with us, his book, The Affirmative Action Myth, the From Equal Treatment to Equal Results chapter, talks a lot about the legal strategy behind some of these efforts, including the Griggs v. Duke Power Company case at the Supreme Court in 1971, which helped to redefine what discrimination is. What was the role of courts in implementing some of these affirmative action policies?
Well, it was largely a negative role, unfortunately. And what the courts did that was so harmful is that they indulged the efforts of what today we would call the administrative state, federal bureaucrats, who attempted to interpret laws that Congress had passed, legislation that had been passed, in ways that Congress, that the lawmakers had never intended. So you get a Civil Rights Act of 1964 that says, you know, decisions must be made without regard to race. It's right there in black and white. Yet you have administrators and federal agencies reinterpreting this language and issuing guidances out to states and school districts and so forth that says just the opposite of that, that racial imbalance is evidence of discrimination, and then the courts indulging this manipulation of the language in decisions like Griggs. And that's been the problem, that the courts have indulged the jujitsu that has taken place in terms of manipulating very, very clear instructions, legislative instructions on how policy must be made. What the difference is. I mean, the lawmakers that put in place the Civil Rights Act of 1964 said very clearly, desegregation does not mean racial balance in outcomes. That is not what we're talking about here. We're talking about giving people the opportunity, say, to go to a different school. That is what we're talking about. If they choose not to go to that school, that is not evidence that segregation still exists. And yet that's how the courts would later interpret it. And so that was the negative role that the court system played. Mm-hmm. And it's led to a lot of damage, I believe.
Late in the book, you say that race preference policies benefits that tend to go to blacks who are already better off rather than to the black underclass. Is that a bug of affirmative action policies, or is that actually a feature in the way that they're carried out?
Oh, I think it's definitely a bug. For starters, it's not the way the policies have been sold to the public. Affirmative action has long been sold as a way to help the black poor. And yet we've seen the poor retrogress under affirmative action while wealthier blacks became even more better off. So if you go back to the late 1960s, you can just look at, say, the first 25 years of affirmative action, so through the early 1990s. So between the late 1960s and the early 1990s, the top 20% of black earners saw their income share grow at about the same rate as the white counterparts, top 20% of whites. But the bottom 20% of black earners saw their share of income fall at nearly double the rate of their white counterparts at the bottom. So the black poor have become worse off. In the late 1960s, so that's just incomes right there. Mm-hmm. But in terms of labor force participation, you can also see it there. In the late 1960s, the least educated blacks, if you just look at that group, 80% of them had jobs. You fast forward 25 years, it's down to just 50% of them having jobs. That's the era of affirmative action. That is the track record of affirmative action. And so what was interesting, I mentioned earlier that the impetus for the book was the Supreme Court decision. And a lot of that apocalyptic talk about the decimation of the black middle class, if racial preferences go away, it was coming from black elites. It was coming from Barack Obama and Michelle Obama and black academics and black media talking heads and so forth. They were the ones who were up in arms about this. And the data I just showed you explains why these policies have mostly benefited that class of blacks.
Jason Riley with us, his book, The Affirmative Action Myth. There's some discussion of DEI policies inside the book. I was remembering a study from 2022. On the University of Michigan campus about their DEI programs, spent hundreds of millions of dollars, and the survey said that students and faculty both had a less positive campus climate, less sense of belonging, less likely to interact with people of a different race or religion or with different politics, the exact opposite of the intention of DEI policies. Are those DEI programs making the same mistakes that we saw with affirmative action programs?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's affirmative action by other means. There's really no change in terms of the goals of affirmative action, the goals of DEI, and the methods. And so yes, DEI is affirmative action, and you see the results. And Michigan is a very good poster child for this phenomenon because I believe they spent more on these programs than any other large public university, and they've been at it for a while. And they just, I believe, rolled back some of their DEI programming. Mm-hmm. And between 2016 and 2025, over the past 10 years or so, they spent something like $250 million on this stuff. And those survey results you just referred to, that's their internal polling and assessment of the effectiveness of of these programs. So it turns out, apparently, you know, raising the salience of race in a multicultural environment does not bring us all together. It leads to more division. And, you know, that's a point. It's an important point to keep in mind because so many people on the left like to say there's strength in diversity. Our diversity is our strength as a country, as this multi-ethnic, multicultural country. And no, that is not the strength of our country. The strength of our country has been to overcome our differences in terms of cultures and focus on what unites us. That's been our strength. And to the extent that we don't do that and focus instead on where we differ, however superficially, it's been a disaster. And that's what DEI does. And that's why affirmative action programs are so divisive. Most of the country is not in favor of racial preferences. That's most of the country who's black, most of the country who's white, most of the country who's Asian, Hispanic, down the road. These policies are popular with a small elite group of people, particularly on the left, who like to engage in social engineering.
Got a question for Jason Riley, his book, The Affirmative Action Myth. You wrote a previous book called Please Stop Helping Us, and there's some discussion toward the conclusion about how affirmative action policies overlap with the expansion of the welfare state around the same time, the early 1970s and into the future. How are those two programs linked, and how do we work to both decouple and deconstruct them in the future?
The central claim that underlies many of the arguments in favor of affirmative action is that statistical disparities among groups result from how others are treating those groups instead of from the performances of those groups, that the performances are less important. How other groups are treating them is more important. And I think that gets it exactly backwards. The progress that we were talking about that took place in the first two-thirds of the 20th century, it took place at a time when other people were treating blacks horribly. The government was treating blacks horribly. Mm-hmm. But that did not stop the progress that we saw, progress that has been unmatched in the era of affirmative action when other groups were treating blacks favorably and giving them special treatment. So I think the focus needs to be on a group building its human capital, focusing on producing the right attitudes and behaviors and habits that are conducive to upward mobility. And when you do that, it doesn't matter how other groups treat you in a free market capitalist society. That's not what will matter most. What will matter most is how productive you are, what your contributions can be.
Jason L. Riley, he is the author of the new book, The Affirmative Action Myth, Why Blacks Don't Need Racial Preferences to Succeed. Also a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, columnist for the Wall Street Journal. Jason, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thank you, Scott.
That will wrap up this edition of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Our thanks to Dr. Brad Berger, talking about Ray Bradbury, and Jason L. Riley, his new book, The Affirmative Action Myth. Remember, you can hear new episodes every week on this station. You also can find extended versions of some of our interviews or listen anytime to the podcast. Find it at podcast.hillsdale.edu or wherever you get your audio. Until next week, I'm Scott Bertram, and this has been the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
If you ever wanted to unlock your musical potential, Cascade Curations not only has great music, art, and fashion, we also offer fun and exciting music lessons for all ages and skill levels. Whether you dream of playing the piano, guitar, drums, or vocals, our instructors will guide you every step of the way. With flexible scheduling and personalized instruction, you'll be playing your own tunes in no time. Don't just listen to music, create it. Call or text us at 530-255-4855 to book your first lesson. Cascade Curations, where we believe anyone can learn to play their own song.
For over 50 years, House of Realty has provided experienced and effective advice to its real estate clients. Experts in residential, commercial, and investment property, we have the knowledge and tools to assist you with all of your real estate needs. Family owned and operated since 1965, we have been an active part of the Shasta County community for generations. Please call House of Realty today at 241-8300, a reputation for excellence since 1965.
Summer travel is here, and it can be tough on a vehicle. Whether it's dust or dirt, pollution or road grime, stop by Quick and Clean Car Wash at the corner of Market and Eureka Way in downtown Reading. They offer car wash packages starting at $11. Quick and Clean's gentle, automated pull-through wash includes a hand scrub pre-clean and a personal towel dry exit. Save money, save water at Quick and Clean Car Wash at the corner of Market and Eureka Way in downtown Reading.
At Cornerstone Community Bank, you're more than just a customer. You're our friends, neighbors, the local businesses where we shop, and the restaurants where we dine. Your success strengthens our community. Come meet our amazing teams in Reading, Red Bluff, and our newest location in Anderson, and find out why we are more than banking. Cornerstone Community Bank, member FDIC and equal housing lender.
This Hawaiian mini vacation is brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning. So what does professional office cleaning have to do with relaxing in a tropical paradise? Frankly, nothing. But Maui Bob and the crew want to remind you to be sure to take the time for what's important in this workaday world. Family, friends, and yes, even yourself. And if their professional office cleaning services can help you make that time, give them a call at 221-5868. This Hawaiian mini vacation was brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning, 221-5868.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.